I wanted to talk about I admit the title is not very explanatory, but you will see what I'm trying to do. Before I start, I wanted to say that this is, of course, the work of a lot of people in my group. And in particular, I want to acknowledge Dr. Yuming Liu, who's in the audience there. And he and I are tremendously enjoying this workshop, and for this we have to thank the sponsors. It's one of the better conferences that we have gone to in recent years, in fact. So without further ado, let me give you an idea of what I'm talking about. This whole work has to do with a recent effort in my, that I'm very interested to do and our group has been working on. Namely, you can classify this as in the category of direct numerical simulations of waves, right? And so phase-resolved direct numerical simulation. So the question is it still, has it gotten to a point where it is now becoming somewhat practical for us to do that? And if so, what kind of practical problems can we do with the kind of calculations that we can do? So the motivation basically is that there has been tremendous advances in wave sensing technology, in modeling of nonlinear waves, and in high-performance computing. And so the constellation of the three, the convergence of the three, suggests that this might be a time for us to again try to perform large-scale phase-resolved simulations of nonlinear wave fields. And the final point maybe is the punchline, namely to obtain practically useful deterministic reconstruction and forecasting for whatever purposes. In particular, what I'd like to do today is to use the excuse of a particular application, namely of helping ships handle rough seas as a motivator for the kind of applications. But by and large, the notion is that if you can do it, then you can use it to study all kinds of things. So the question is, can it be done? So the objective is that if we are successful, then we hope to provide a new framework for a simulation, integration, and deployment of sensing and so forth. So you can think of a way of understanding what you've got as you measure the ocean and try to model it and so forth. The notion is that we wanted to do deterministic phase resolve prediction of wave evolution. And the particular application is the one I'm using as a motivator today, namely SWASH. The reason I like to use this ship handling as a motivator is because it puts a tremendous demand on how fast we can do the calculations. Ideally, what you want to do is to be able to do it in real time. Because if you could predict something that a person or automated ship control has to avoid the following day after it has already sunk, right? It's not very useful. So ideally, you want to be able to somehow, because of all the sensing deployment and so forth, you want to be able to send instructions to the person or to the machine and say, steer left, right? Full rudder to the left so that, because then you can steer right again to avoid this big clump of waves, right? I mean, so it's real time, it's really the objective. Otherwise, it's not very interesting. So this is a busy picture, but I think you get the sense. So we're interested in some kind of a program that can take different kinds of sensing, all different kinds of sensing, wave probes, satellites, whatever you have, provide a reconstruction of the entire nonlinear wave field and deterministically, right? And also to have at the same time capability of simulating ship motions, whether they will capsize, how much roll motion, whatever it is, right, to use a controller to control the ships, right, through a simulation, and then provide some kind of an optimal path so that you can accomplish a particular goal, like minimize the vertical acceleration of this ship during this 10 minutes of time, right, as you transit from point A to point B. So this seems like a dream. So the question is, are we realistic in terms of being able to do that, right? So let me... You see. Okay. Yeah. It's about 30 kilometers by 30 kilometers as an example that we'll give you today. Right. So eventually. No, not yet. Yeah, but eventually, of course, the idea is that maybe you have lots of things deployed in that area and you have multiple ways of sensing, right? Everybody's measuring for each other. You might have probes or buoys. You might have airplanes flying over, right? And everybody's feeding data into this reconstruction, and then you can operate in that environment. So that's the right. So the approach is, it's a very busy slide, but for this audience, since because of the very interesting talks we heard about rotational flow, this is irrotational flow, potential flow so far. So basically, we're extending this mode coupling idea, which uses large numbers of modes and can account for arbitrary, at some level, arbitrary nonlinear order m, m equal to 3, 4, 5, 6, would account for quartet, quintet, sextet, heptet interactions, right? But not really accounting for in the sense of counting, but actually, you know, just simulating it. We have known that this method is one of a candidate because it has fairly good convergence rate or exponential convergence rate with M and N, doesn't get much better than that. And also the computational effort is almost linear. And what we've done is that we've included onto this capability, finite depth and variable bottom topography, which is important in many of these applications. We included the presence of an ambient current that might be variable, which might be refract-diffract the waves. We included some notion of dissipation due to wave breaking, and I'll explain how we did it. It's not really a model. I wouldn't say we modeled it. A lot of work yet to be done. And so far, not model wind forcing, bottom friction, viscous effect, and so forth, right? But some of these things we think we know how to add. The hard part is that a lot of work has been done on understanding, say, forcing or dissipation, but not in this phase-resolved, mechanistic, physical-scale context, right? So we have to reinterpret into, you put pressure on the backside of the wave, not the front. If you have a long wave in front of a short wave, then there's a little sheltering. I mean, all that has to be put in. But the model would allow us to put it in a straightforward way, much more straightforward than if you were to do it in a phase average sense, because then the physics is out, right? So what we did was that we cooked up a scheme where we could do nonlinear wave field reconstruction using multiple level optimization. And I guess so for this audience, I guess I have to say that, you know, I haven't made any proof of uniqueness or anything. The assumption is that the wave nonlinearity must not be so large that I don't get a unique answer, right? So, but so far we've been able to get good answers by a certain scheme, right? And so I must not be looking at waves that steep yet. But I'll show you examples where we compare to experiments and so forth, and they compare, right? So basically, again, arbitrary order of nonlinearity doesn't mean very, very steep waves, which means we can use m equals to 3, 4, 5, 6 successively to account for more and more interactions. We have now put it on very large computing platforms to make it very fast. And we have yet to do it for very, very complicated different kinds of sensing data, different errors, and so forth, which we haven't done. And we implemented it on high-performance computing platforms. And you asked a question earlier. We've now gone up to 10,000 kilometers square and several hours, 10 to the 3 or 4 seconds, n equal to 100 million modes total, and m goes to about 3 or 4 orders, 3 to 5 orders. This is very old result in 87. This just to convince people that, you know, if you do this, use this method HOS for Stokes wave, you can easily see that we obtain, in fact, exponential convergence with n and m, as one might expect, until the wave steepness become large, and we at that time reported maybe 80% of Stokes steepness. It's easier of Stokes limiting steepness. It's easy to look at a Stokes wave and say that, but when you have complicated wave train, it's really not clear how far we could go. And again, it's one of those things, if we could compute successfully, then we haven't gone high enough. And if we couldn't, then something happens. And I'll show you the kind of thing. One of the things we did at that time was to study a very steep wave, which we had computed by Lagrangian methods. And then we used this high-order spectral method to compute it. The question was, what happens if the wave that we're trying to model is steeper than what we are able to model with very high order? And what we found very interesting is a very robust response of the model. Namely, it comes up with the best fit, if you may, of this wave, which actually has already overturned, right? And whatever energy it couldn't represent, it just loses, right? It loses because it cascades away through the cutoff at the very high wave number n, right? And another interesting example we ran, similar to this notion, was that we compare a set of experiments done by Ming Yang Su in a tank where he sent a packet down, right? The reason why we're very interested in experiments is that he was very careful to record a sequence of events, crescent shape breaking, intense two-dimensional breaking, and so forth, of this train as it went down, right? Now, obviously, we don't have a breaking model other than losing energy at some high wave number, some kind of a filter at high wave number, in fact, what we've done. And what we found is that we were able to simulate this packet all the way right past all of these intense breaking events. Right? And this is a plot of the energy of our calculation, right? So we conserve energy great when the wave is not steep, and we go losing energy, right? And then we come out clean on this end, and then we kept on comparing to the experiment, right? So this is a very interesting. Now, a similar calculation we did with results of this is total energy, total potential kinetic energy versus initial energy. One is equal to initial energy. So in this case, we've lost a 20%. 20% of the energy was lost through this process. Right. Okay. This is a set of experiments that was done by using Stokes waves that become unstable and broke down because of the growth of the sideband instability. And so what you see are the hollow symbols are experiments from Tulane and Waseda. And what we've done is that we've actually done the calculation, and these solid symbols and the line that passes through them are our calculation. So as you can see, as these a tremendous amount of breaking happens, right, we seem to be able to maintain more or less the hollow circles is what the experiment says, and the solid ones are the ones predict, right, and so forth. So it's not perfect. It's not even a model. It seems to be able to allow some breaking or some loss of energy in breaking to go through as we do these calculations. Now, we have now become more sophisticated, which is I'm not going to show you. It's looking at different ways of filtering it out, but still it's not a model, right, that might be somewhat more realistic and so forth, right. Now, I mentioned that we extended into finite depth and so forth. This is a particular calculation where we send waves on a surface over a very complicated bottom. And it's very interesting because the multi-wave interaction problem extends to waves on the bottom, except that they have no frequency, right? So all of the Phillips diagrams and so forth work except that the frequency is zero. And then this is a result that we've published using this HOS method. And these are experiments. Are the symbols, and the solid curves are our prediction, and we predict a very complicated some different frequencies and various reflection coefficient as a function of the distance over this seabed and so forth, and these results are obtained. So we actually incorporate that into HOS so that we can deal with a variable bottom, and then the question is how about currents, and we've also extended it so that we have done currents. So this will be a situation where the current profile increases, right, over a ramp, the wave comes, and eventually you can see that there's a reflection point and so forth. And this is not a new result, but it's now incorporated into HOS capability. This is interesting because since we have the nonlinear capability, we are able to calculate, say, for m equal to 1, which is a linear calculation, and then we put in higher value of m, and we can look at the difference between the linear and the nonlinear result of this wave reaching a turning point here. Okay, so this is the kind of calculation we have done. So, of course, we are now interested in the nonlinear wave. Now, a lot of people would say, well, why is it so important that we do the nonlinear problem? Turns out the nonlinearity is tremendously important for this kind of application. I'm sorry, I skipped myself. This is another example of how we have now put this wave current interaction capability into a HOS. So this is a calculation of a current coming this way, wave coming this way. There is a current profile that goes from A to B. It's a very complicated problem, right? And I'm showing you the details of the results from A and B with or without current. And obviously, with current and without current, the solutions are very different for this problem. And the spectrum, of course, are also very different as a result of this wave co-propagating with this current or not. So basically, we need to include current in our kind of calculation if there is current, right? So this is the statement of the problem, right? The statement of the problem is the following, right? You have a nonlinear wave field propagating. You have all different kinds of ways of measuring it, right? Probes, point probes, radar images, satellite image, what have you. And the question is, can you then do some kind of a calculation and obtain this, right? And this is space, time, all the kinematics, right? This is deterministic phase resolved. It's a fairly complete solution to the problem, right? And that's the question. Now, the assumptions we made are that fairly very general assumptions, that the frequency band is limited. There is a minimum wave frequency and maximum one so that we can bound the group velocities. And then the direction is also bounded, right? We make no assumptions otherwise about the statistic of the wave field, right? At some level, the details or information about the wave field is provided to us by the measurements at which we use it to reconstruct, right? The only thing I would say is that, you know, as time and space go on, these numbers don't change. We just fix them, right? So otherwise, the characteristic of the wave itself may be changing with time. And we may also make the assumption, in at least this talk, that the measurement data is exact, although we've done direct simulation Monte Carlo and actually even tried some polynomial chaos type calculation, just to be able to bound the errors in our prediction versus the errors in the measurements. And so far, because of the fairly, perhaps, not very strong nonlinearity, there are no surprises. The errors in the prediction are scaled by the errors in the input and so forth, according to our Monte Carlo simulation. Okay, and so far, no wind forcing, bottom friction viscosity that we have not included so far. Some of them we might be able to include in some crude way, but right now there's none of that, right? So there's no wind and so forth. So this is a flow chart, right? And it has a little bit to do with how we think about this problem, and it, some of the details is important. The key detail is that we basically prescribe the entire wave field, right? Many, many, many modes, right? Direction, frequency, amplitude. They all interact. And then we compare it to what we have as measurement and obtain least square norms, and you can think about it and iterate again. The key thing is that we use a cascade, if you may, a multiple level of simulation. So we started with Stokes waves formulation that we can write down, right? And then we go up to HOS and we increase systematically M from small to large, right? So this might be a reason why even if there were another solution out there, we would always find this solution because the initial condition is fairly rational if you think about it, right? The initial condition would have worked if these waves were linear, right? Or second order, right? Or third order, right? And then we build this up. And finally, when the error is very small, then we output this. But this is sort of a cartoon that there's a little bit of details involved, right? This is an example. This is an experiment done at TAMU. I have a former student who is at Texas A&M University, and he has control of some facilities. So every time I call him, he will make me some runs. So this is an example where at point A, you are given the data, right? This is space-time, from 0 to capital T. And this is the answer. The answer is the reconstruction of the dashed line. And during the time that you have the data, it compares very well, of course. And then beyond, we don't know. And then if you look at C, which is a somewhat down wave, there is a piece which we can predict where T2 is that the corresponds very well. And beyond T2, it slowly does not compare again. And upstream, a similar result where we know from T1 to T2 is our predicted. One can easily get the results of the sort of predictable region. And indeed, we verify according to experiments that the regions that we think are predictable, in fact, are predictable compared to experiments.
Is this still a wave plume, so all the waves are going in
the same direction? That's right. But our reconstruction assumes that the wave only goes from left between minus pi over 2 and pi over 2, right? There are no waves coming back.
Okay. But in this case, though, all the waves...
This is a one-dimensional wave, yeah. Single, one wave from going left to right. Yes. And then we looked at, for example, of course, if you account for nonlinearity, the predictable zone changes. And maybe a side bonus is if the waves are nonlinear, in fact, the predictable region is larger than the linear region because the group velocities are bunched closer together. Right. So, again, I have lots of results. So let me go quickly. If I have time, I'll come back. One of the things we were very concerned about is because we were going to drive a ship or something into it, the ship will actually be affected by the particle orbit velocities we predict. So I'm really interested to know how important are, how well are we predicting things like kinematics and so forth, right? And so one maybe not surprising thing is this. It's fairly easy to make a reconstruction that matches the surface elevation. But if you now look at the particle orbits, if you don't get the right wave kinematics in, then you're way off, right? So this is an example where, these, again, are experiments at TAMU, these symbols, right? And if you use linear theory, you could be way off, especially near the water surface. And if you use higher order, then they are right on top again, right? So this is this is the horizontal velocity. And then, again, a similar result if you look at a different time, right, and so forth. So basically, it's quite easy. I mean, one can imagine if you give me the entire free surface, I would do a Fourier decomposition and find you a series of linear waves that actually has that elevation, right? Now, of course, after time, it will not be anymore. But even in that case, if you look at the kinematics, you are completely off, right? If you look at, so this is an example, actually, we have some experiments from forces on a column, on a pile, right? And we compare the experiments to reconstruction. And if you use linear theory, the linear theory are the blue dashed lines, right? And experiments are the solid black line. And you can be way off, right? Quite a bit off, right? Because accelerations, again, is another manifestation of this issue. But if you use, say, HOS, M equal to 4, actually the comparisons are really quite remarkable. Now, this is also a reconstruction problem, which means in this experiment, they had a probe at a point in the tank, right? again for a piece of time, and we reconstructed the entire wave tank, get all the particle orbits at R, right, and calculated the forces on that pile. Right. So the take-home lesson from these kind of things is that wave nonlinearity is critical for this kind of work that we want to do, even for relatively moderate Cs. I don't have all of it reported, but some of the earlier results, Ka was just, you know, a very small number, right? What was it? 0.1, 0.23, okay? Right. Now, another thing that's very, very important is because we're doing large-scale computations, if we are off even by a little bit on the phase speed, for example, right, then after a while, it's incoherent, right? So this nonlinear effect is totally non-trivial. If you did a linear theory or low-order theory, in fact, it is quite inadequate, right? Right, because we are now looking at many, many ways over a long time, propagating, interacting, right? I mean, not considering the nonlinear interactions, resonant interactions, just to get the phases right. If you didn't get it right, after a while, the sum of the waves would give you a totally different surface, right? So this is the kind of interesting problem that we're interested in to do. This is a typical example. We used 3 minutes of data at a particular probe A, and we calculated the wave at two downstream locations, one 500 meters down, the other one 1 kilometer down, right? And so this is space, if you may, right? And this is A is where we measured, B, C are the two places where we are comparing, and this is the original wave field, right? This is the reconstructed one, and this is actually the error, the subtraction of the two. Now, it turns out that it satisfied completely. It satisfied completely. We could predict this zone in space-time, right? Right. So the notion is that a particular probe is responsible for giving us a predictability region, right? But it is confined in a particular space-time region, right? So we could argue, we could demand more data or how much we need, depending on what you need to do where, right? Because each probe, okay? Right. So let me move on, right? Okay. Right. Now, we extended to short-crested waves, so far what you've seen are these one-directional waves, right? And it's not very difficult. If you have one wave, the predictable zone at any particular time, you can imagine, polygon to T, it's between x1 and x2, if you may, right, according to nonlinear group speeds and so forth, right? And if you have two waves, then it would be this kind of a rhombus shape. And if you have many, many waves, of course, you would always get this. I really like this because to explain to students, really nice, because every time we calculate, we see this fan shape, right? And this is how the fan shape came about, because you just basically take this argument on the left and just rotate it through all the waves, right? And you always get this fan shape, which is a particular time, right, in space. Now, if you have a time evolution, then the picture is clearer. So this is a case where, looking down from the airplane, XY plane, you have a station where you're measuring here, right, from, say, 0 to T0, right? And what happens is that the predictable region looks like this, right? And blue is hindcasting because it was before you start measuring, right? Red is reconstruction because it happens between 0 and T0. And green is forecasting because the time associated with this region is past the time that my measurements are going, right? Now, as we start going down this path, actually the difference between these three is actually artificial. After a while, we don't think of it that way anymore, right? It's just that you have some probe measurements. They need not be probes. They could be anything, right? And then they are responsible for substantial portions of the space-time shape that you can predict these things, right? At some level, using a point probe is the most difficult of the problems, right? If you give me a photograph of the surface or a map of the surface velocity, in fact, it's an easier reconstruction problem, right? Huh? Oh, my goodness. I actually have some very good illustrations. So this is an example. Let me go very quickly. This is an example of a case where we have a series of measurement probes at A. We want to predict regions at B. The bottom left is actually the error. If it's dark blue, the error is very small. And so you can imagine. And these are two particular probes in that region where the error has been shown to be small. Let me move quickly because I really want to show you. This is, again, an experiment in a TEMU tank where they have a segmented wave maker on one side producing a wave that focuses in 3D, became very steep, and we were able to predict the focusing. And this is A is a probe. A belongs to a class of probe that we have used, and B belongs to a class of probes we have not used, but we use our reconstruction to compare to, and the comparison is excellent. So we know how we can do this kind of thing. Let me just move on. So our interest is to do large calculations. So this is a kind of agenda we have. So I'm going to show you a result of 30 by 30 kilometers. Right now, this requires 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5 hours of processes of, say, a typical SP3 processor. And because we use several hundred, right now we can do it in about a factor of 500 of simulation time to real time. Okay, but we believe in the very near future, as we go to 2,000 processes, we could, within a year or so, get down to order one, which means real-time simulation for a 30-kilometer square. Right, and these are the kind of cases where people think we could really have some payout applications. So let me give you an example of what a big field like this looks like. Okay. Because the field is so big, if we have plotted it, it would have exhausted the pixels on the computer, right? So we have to fly down and look at a region and so forth. So all of these are deterministically predicted. So this is 30 kilometer square evolution over about half an hour, sea state 8, et cetera, we use 10 to 4 time steps, we use 16 million modes, 100 hour simulation time with 256 processes on T3. All right. Now, let me go real quick in 1 minute. Okay, so what we did was that we took a nonlinear ship motion program. Right, I have something to do with it, okay? And we actually used the HOS wave field kinematics that we've now obtained and put it as boundary conditions on the ship hull, right? Okay? So, again, this is a kind of program. This program has the feature that it can do very large things, right? Okay? Okay? And that's important because we're looking at large motion, right? Very steep waves, okay? So it can do this stuff, right? This ship coming in and out of the water and so forth, right? And I won't click on everything else. If you're interested, I'll show you more later, right? And then what we did was that we incorporated it into a path optimization control algorithm, right? And so the idea is that, can you find me a path from start to finish, okay, of this path? Now, this picture in the background is moving in time, right? But it's deterministically predictable. That's the key, right? Okay, so now what do we do? And so this is very complicated. I'll skip this. There's a whole sort of loop that shows the control theorem. And I'll show you some of that. So this is a case where we ran ships from A to B, point-to-point transit. We want to minimize heave motion. And it shows a reduction of 34% if we path optimize, which is the blue one, right? And I'll show you an example. Maybe this is not important for this audience, but to some other audience, they have to see this ship. So this is and you can actually see this ship steering and so forth. And again, this whole field is deterministically predicted. That's what's amazing about this problem, okay? Right? And then, of course, we found that, right? And I'll show you other examples where we have found, say, 48% decrease in the slope of the ship in a particular direction, as you might want. And the red one is the one without optimization, and the green one is the one with path optimization, steering optimization. And then sometimes if you say you want a very important person that needs to step off the boat, right? So you need a calm for 15 seconds or something. And actually the ship will look for this region in the ocean, go straight there and then stay, right? And then reach this calm period, right? And I have a movie to show it. Yes, yes. And so this is another movie which I won't click on, right? And finally, let me just end with this beautiful movie, and then I will go, okay? So this is an example, this is a real example. People came to us and say, how about if we want to land a helicopter on a CG-47, on a frigate, right? Okay? Is it right? So this is an example where we have a CG-47, the real ship, the full geometry, right? In the seaway, sea state 6, going at 10 knots head speed. And the question is, can you now help me find time windows where this thing could land, right? So we actually think of a color scheme because we're talking to operators now, right? So green means it's landable because this is Navy, U.S. Navy published criteria for landing and taking off. And red means no good. Yellow means very close, right? Right? And the top bar is predicted. The bottom is actual. Left is earlier time, right is future time. And of course, in actual, we don't know the future. And the question is, if this matches up, it means we're predicting it very well to actually experience by the ship to what we say it is. And the operator could look ahead and make decisions, right? So this is, I just want to end with this movie. I just want to end with this movie. We could chat a bit. So you can see the regions of landability, right, or takeoff ability coming, right? And we don't know if this is going to be, but you can color the deck so that the pilot could decide whether he wants to put the stick down or not, right? And then you can see that the actual measurement by the ship versus what we predict, right, is excellent. And you can now see very bad sea state because it was sea state 6 or 7 we had, right? And then you have some regions, and depending on who you're operating, then you can then proceed. So let me just go close this and go to the conclusion. The conclusion basically is that we've demonstrated the elements of a capability called swash. We believe that real-time swash capability is likely in the near term, and we have actually a research plan to get there. And that's basically the conclusion. Thank you.